Nuclear blind spots. Why do people not understand that low-level radiation represents a danger to their health? The nuclear industry and its codependent shills insist that any radiation exposure less than that which comes from a nuclear bomb or an exploding Chernobyl is no big deal. Don't worry your pretty little head about it. Ignore those naysayers and alarmists who tell you otherwise. They don't know what they're talking about. But then you hear from a genuine expert, one with major credentials and a history of being acknowledged as knowing what he's talking about, and you ask him why it's so hard to get the industry, the media, and beyond them, the public, to take low-level radiation exposure seriously as a health risk. And he tells you,
"It is difficult to get a man to understand a thing when his salary depends upon him not understanding it. It is in my scientific work on this topic, I'm a detector scientist, I worked at NASA, it is very obvious to me that the establishment has missed a fundamental aspect of how ionizing radiation causes injury to the body. And we give them signatures and lab coats and expect that they're good and that they know things about topics that they claim to be experts about. And we have failed regarding low doses of ionizing radiation and the harm it causes to our genetic material."
Well, when researcher, mathematician, and inventor Aaron Datesman explains why there is officially unacknowledged danger from low-level radiation, and why, and he co-authors a book to explain the dangers and dirty secrets of nuclear power in an era of climate change, you get a very specific scientific explanation of the problems we face from that dangerous, deadly, awful seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with the co-authors of a brilliant new book, Dirty Secrets of Nuclear Power in an Era of Climate Change, Doug Brigge and Aaron Datesman. We'll get to their impressive credentials later. They provide new, detailed information about nuclear power dangers, including clarification on what happened with the radiation plume at Three Mile Island, information I take very personally. And we'll let you know how you can access this book for free. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than anyone in the United States is thinking about this week, because the presidential election is next Tuesday. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 28, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., bad news for Holtec, the company that wants to reopen the Palisades nuclear reactor in Michigan after 5 years of it being shut down. Corrosion cracking has been found in the steam generators that far exceeded estimates, raising serious questions about the ability of the facility to be restarted, let alone what the cost increase is likely to look like for Holtec. The release of these findings comes the same week that the Biden administration finalized a $1.52 billion conditional loan guaranteed to the Palisades plant. That looks like a contradiction in terms. It's guaranteed, but conditional. The units each have 16,000 steam generator tubes, and it has been found that 1,163 of those tubes had indications of the stress, corrosion, and cracking. In Southern California, Parts of the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station were shut in 2012 after steam generators that had a design flaw leaked. Problems with the new generators led to the closure of the plant in 2013. So while Holtec has announced that it wants to return the plant to operation by late next year, 2025, the company is trying to get approval from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to fix, not replace, these steam generators. In the words of the late, great Kurt Vonnegut, it sounds like Holtec is doing as much tap dancing and farting as they possibly can to keep their plans on track. Meanwhile, their scheme is being vigorously opposed by safe energy NGOs, including Michigan Safe Energy Future, Kalamazoo Chapter, Shutdown Palisades Campaign, and Beyond Nuclear. This latest copycat game of let's restart a dead nuke is now playing itself out in Iowa, as Next Era Energy is conducting engineering studies and speaking with federal regulators about the possible restart of its Duane Arnold nuclear power plant near Palo. Duane Arnold, which sounds like a relative of Roseanne's, was shut down in 2020, meaning it has been on the blocks for 4 years. Next Era's CEO, John Ketchum, boasted, "We have optimism of being able to do this," meaning a restart, "at an attractive price and without much risk," which makes one wonder exactly what the dude is on. In addition to plans to restart Duane Arnold and Palisades, they're talking about restarting Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. All this ignores the fact that the longer a nuclear plant is shut down, the higher the chances that corrosion and other issues could prevent a restart. In Southern California, only 30 miles from downtown Los Angeles, new discharge readings show runoff from the Santa Susana Field Lab, one of California's most polluted sites, carries disturbing levels of radionuclides and other toxins. This according to a legal brief filed by Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility and allied groups. These revelations stem from stronger monitoring standards recently added to the water pollution permit for Boeing Corporation, the primary operator of the Santa Susana Field Laboratory, and these are tougher standards that Boeing is seeking to quash in court. The new discharge detection data from site outfalls reveals concentrations of radionuclides, including radium-226 and 228 and strontium-90, in addition to elevated levels of aluminum, manganese, mercury, sulfate, and dioxins 3 to 30 times the permit's effluent limits, otherwise known as PFAs. Boeing's response? They're suing the regional board in LA Superior Court to invalidate the new detection terms. I guess they just can't handle the truth. From CNN comes a story headlined, "Biden makes clear AI can't launch nukes," to which Nuclear Hot Seat adds, "Not yet." And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuts of the Week.
I almost don't know where to start with this one. The Department of Energy Office of Nuclear Energy wants to help cultivate the future nuclear workforce and finds that it's important to engage youth at an early age. So what have they done? They have issued a comic book. The latest edition of Spark Squad comic book series, and this is from the DOE, features nuclear energy. And its release has been timed to coincide with Nuclear Science Week 2024. Yeah, let's get the little buggers and twist their minds before they have a chance to have a single critical faculty about nuclear. DOE's propaganda comic book and animation is geared towards younger readers and follows three middle schoolers on a quest to collect enough joules, J-O-U-L-E-S, which is a measurement of energy used in the nuclear field, and are excited to find out about uranium fuel's energy density. They do so via a trip to a coal plant that has been converted to nuclear. Boy, is that a projection of future issues or what? And there's a game of dodgeball between uranium-235 atoms and neutron balls atoms that shows the squad how to start and sustain a chain reaction. Just the thing to do for your science fair. As well as the Spark Squad comic book, The DOE has developed the Dodgeball Fission activity and worked with its national labs to create an accompanying STEM toolkit to help engage learners of all ages in accepting all things nuclear completely uncritically. And that's why DOE and your Spark Squad brainiacs and the schools that actually allow in Nuclear Science Week 2024, you are all this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat Num Nuts of the Week.
And we have one of the cutesy visuals from that comic book on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 697.
Nuclear Hot Seat Num Nuts of the Week.
And award-winning environmental journalist Carl Grossman has a new article out on Counterpunch. The New Nuclear Push, New Package, Same Lies. We will have a link to it up on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 697. In Japan, accolades keep rolling in for Nihon Hidyanko, the Japanese Confederation of A&H Bomb Sufferers Organizations, the recipient of the 2024 Nobel Peace Prize. The group has released a statement saying it believes it was named this year's winner of the Nobel Peace Prize due to the highly appreciated work of each and every atomic bomb survivor, or hibakusha as they are called. The group commended hibakusha for consistently calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons through their testimonies of painful experiences so that no one else would have to suffer the same pain. The Norwegian Nobel Committee has announced that Terumi Tanaka, the 92-year-old co-chair of Nihon Hidyanko, will give a speech at the 2024 Nobel Peace Prize Award Ceremony in Oslo on December 10. Mr. Tanaka has also been urging Japan to sign the Anti-Nuclear Arms Treaty, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, while pushing Tokyo for greater support for victims and lobbying global governments for measures to prevent nuclear war and abolish nuclear weapons. At the still deadly radioactive remains of the Fukushima nuclear power facility, Tokyo Electric Power has resumed what they are now honestly referring to as experimental work to remove nuclear fuel debris from the number 2 reactor. The attempts to remove this debris had been suspended for more than a month because of the need to replace two cameras attached to the debris removal device that, quote-unquote, malfunctioned. What they're not saying in this article is that because the radiation levels were still so high, much too high for a human being to go in and survive, the cameras were also done in, unable to survive the intense blast of radiation that both cameras received. An estimated 880 tons of radioactive debris, a mixture of melted fuel and reactor structure, remain in the plant's 3 reactors. The condition of the debris and various other details are unknown and have remained that way for 13 and a half years. What's this we hear about nuclear power stations being clean and green? Internationally, sharing some good news about the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. One of the tactics that's being taken is to have individual cities, municipalities, counties take a stand against nuclear and thus build pressure to sign the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the United Nations treaty that is international law, in countries that thus far have not done so. The latest word is that in Belgium, thanks to the latest International Day of Peace campaign, run with all the members of the No Nukes Be platform, 10 more municipalities have joined the ICANN Cities Appeal, bringing the total to 143. Belgium has a total of 581 municipalities, so there's still a long way to go before all the local authorities have signed up, but this is an encouraging ratio and good news to share. And in Greece, 80 municipalities out of 332 in Greece are supporting the city's appeal. The current push is to reach 100 cities by the end of the year. And just 3 more are needed to reach 25% of the municipalities in Greece supporting the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. If you wish to get and follow all the news about the city's campaign and work in your country or area to get it passed by your local municipalities? You can follow up by joining the Google group for ICANN Campaigners. In alliance with this, there is an important article that has been published, We Need a UN Study of the Effects of Nuclear War. It's an opinion piece written for the Scientific American by Zia Mian, co-director of Princeton University's Program on Science and Global Security, and co-founder of the Physicists Coalition for Nuclear Threat Reduction. He wrote, At the United Nations, an effort is underway in the General Assembly to establish an international panel of scientists to assess, communicate, and advance our current knowledge of the effects of nuclear war. The effort would lead to a more fully informed and inclusive global debate on how much and how little everyone, including the nuclear-armed states themselves, actually know of the catastrophic, large-scale, long-term, human, environmental, ecological, economic, and social impacts of using nuclear weapons. Ideally, the findings could build a basis for action towards the total elimination of nuclear weapons worldwide and secure a safer future for people and our planet. We will link to this article on our website, nuclearhotseat.com. The episode is 697. In Australia, Queensland's electricians, who are called Sparkies, have been warned of the huge risk to thousands of jobs in renewable energy posed by nuclear plants. The electrical trades union told electricians and apprentices in a mass mail-out on Wednesday that nuclear energy was a, quote, radioactive pipe dream, end quote, and went on to say that there is a huge risk that if what they're being given is a fantasy of a nuclear power station without an entire industrial plan and a renewable plan, they're just going to be thrown on the scrap heap. The union's nuclear energy report for 2024 found nuclear reactors would be more expensive, could not be built before coal exits the electricity grid, and were, quote, simply unnecessary, given abundant renewable energy sources. Also in Australia, opposition leader Peter Dutton has repeatedly cited the Canadian province of Ontario as a model for cheaper power prices from nuclear, and has said that Australia should follow Ontario down the nuclear path. However, Professor Mark Winfield, an academic from York University in Canada who specializes in energy and environment, said the reaction among people in Ontario to the comparison had ranged from disbelief to you couldn't make this up. The seemingly low energy costs in Ontario are because the province subsidizes its citizens' electricity power bills by $7.3 billion Canadian dollars a year from general revenue, making low prices an illusion. Further, in 2015, the Canadian government approved a plan to refurbish 10 aging reactors, but the program has been beset by cost blowouts. Winfield said the last one in Darlington, east of Toronto, was supposed to cost $4 million Canadian dollars and ended up costing $14 billion Canadian dollars. And, Winfield said, that was fairly typical of what we saw, a cost overrun in the range of about 2.5 times overestimate. For nuclear, that's standard operating procedure. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, Nuclear Hot Seat is coming up on its 700th episode next month. Who'da thunk it? When the show started 13 and a half years ago, I thought I'd only be doing it for a short while, until it was no longer needed. Well, guess what? All this time later, it's still needed, because the information you get here is very different from the manufactured, manipulated image of nuclear that the industry and its governmental enablers put out into the world. As you'll hear from this week's interviewees, nuclear is awash in dirty secrets they've covered up in order to guarantee public ignorance, because that ensures that all things nuclear will continue to grow at the government's, meaning the taxpayers, meaning your expense. The only reliable weekly roundup of nuclear stories not influenced by nuclear industry propaganda is this show, Nuclear Hot Seat. We provide you with the stories behind the stories, verifiable facts, genuine experts, humor when possible, and even a touch of musical theater to help the medicine go down. Why? Because when it comes to nuclear, what you don't know not only can hurt you, it probably already has. And you need the kind of information you get here every week to fight back, so the nuclear industry doesn't continue to get away with slow-motion murder of people and the environment. But we can't do it without your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs exclusively on donations, and we can't survive without your support. So if you're grateful for the information you get from this show, the time to help us out is right now. Go to NuclearHotSeat.com and click on the big red donate button. Or send directly via Zelle to info@NuclearHotSeat.com. No amount is too small, no amount is too large. So whatever you can do to help, go to NuclearHotSeat.com and know that I'm deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. An important new book has just been published about the lies of the nuclear industry, put together by two men with impeccable credentials and decades of experience calling nuclear out. Dirty Secrets of Nuclear Power in an Era of Climate Change is a meticulously researched and detailed book that exposes nuclear lies and provides detailed scientific information in common language to back up its claims. Much of it new, and all of it supported by charts, graphics, and clear writing that even the non-scientific among us can understand. The co-authors are Doug Brigge and Aaron Datesman. Dr. Brigge is an endowed professor and chair of the Department of Public Health Sciences at the University of Connecticut. He has published extensively about the social and health consequences of uranium mining. Aaron Datesman is a researcher, mathematician, and inventor who has held technical roles at the United States Department of Energy and as an engineer at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. Together, they have written a book that presents evidence that nuclear power is an insecure and unsecurable technology, inherently incompatible with humanity and democracy, and why it is a less than desirable option in terms of addressing climate change. They make the argument that while superficially appealing, nuclear power is too costly, fragile, and slow to implement compared to alternative options such as wind and solar. What made this interview such a joy was listening to the interplay of two well-matched collaborators who are so comfortable with each other that they often make jokes about their work together while sparking some of the best questions and answers. I spoke with Doug Brigge and Aaron Datesman on September 23rd, 2024. Aaron Datesman and Doug Brigge, thank you so much for joining us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
How did the two of you decide to start working together on this book?
Actually, it was Doug's idea.
It was my idea, but why did you agree to do it? Because I wanted to do the book, and I asked you, but I don't know if I know what convinced you.
Oh, I'm a sucker for a bad idea.
What made it a bad idea at first in your thinking?
I am an electrical engineer by training, and it's not clear that writing a popular science book on any topic is really in my skill set. So this was a growth opportunity for me.
I would say that it was a good growth for you. And over time, we worked together, and I think that it was very productive. So I'm glad you did it, Aaron. And I think you brought things to it that would not be there if I had written it by myself. So I appreciate that. But not just that, Aaron. The story about Jimmy Carter responding to the nuclear accident in Canada and then being president and there at Three Mile Island is a remarkable story that I had never heard. I didn't know that connection. And you brought that in. And I still think that may be the best sort of color part of the book and the entire book. So it's not just the graphs and charts and technical stuff.
The book is entitled Dirty Secrets of Nuclear Power in an Era of Climate Change. Why this book and why now?
You know, there has been a constant campaign for the last 10 or 20 years to sell nuclear power as a response to climate change. And it has bothered me on several levels, starting from my concern about uranium mining, which is where I began in all of this. But over time, I began to just more and more concerns about nuclear power. And I thought there needed to be a popular, accessible, and maybe we didn't make it as accessible as it needed to be, rendering of the problems with that approach.
The ultimate chapter is about something called the opportunity cost. What does that mean, opportunity cost? It's a benefit you forego by the choices that you make. Okay, if you choose path A, had you chosen path B, the benefits might have been different. And so you're losing something by your choice. There was an opportunity cost to the choice to deploy nuclear in the 1960s and 70s that I think we don't really reckon with. And so the way the book closes is by trying to answer, what did we lose by going nuclear? And the answer to that question should inform our decision about whether we would like to adopt nuclear at the present time, for which there was a significant push, for instance. There's been agreement to restart the Three Mile Island Unit 1 just very recently. Personally, I think they probably won't be able to do it, but we're still having these conversations. So the opportunity cost issue is I think, a very important one. That's how the book ends.
Why is there such misunderstanding about the dangers of nuclear power?
I don't know if Aaron and I discussed this, but I think a lot of it is intentional. The advocates for nuclear power have clouded the issue substantially with their framing of the problem or framing of the issue. And basically they are coming from a standpoint of advocacy for nuclear power. And so they put together the strongest argument in their favor. That makes it hard to have an evidence-based, rational discussion of nuclear power in the public sphere to some extent. It would be interesting, Aaron, if you and I disagree on something here. Please, go ahead.
Well, I am sadly a little pithier than Professor Brigge, as I'm not a fancy professor. It is difficult to get a man to understand a thing when his salary depends upon him not understanding it. It is in my scientific work on this topic, I'm a detector scientist, I worked at NASA, it is very obvious to me that the establishment has missed a fundamental aspect of how ionizing radiation causes injury to the body. And we give them signatures and lab coats and expect that they're good and that they know things about topics that they claim to be experts about. And we have failed regarding low doses of ionizing radiation and the harm it causes to our genetic material. The authorities have failed to understand something that they clearly had the portfolio assigned to them to understand. It was their duty to understand and do the math correctly, and they failed, in my opinion.
So this would be a willful blind spot on the part of those within the industry?
That is a fair telling. Yeah, I won't dispute that. It's an industry sort of government nexus. Very often it is essentially the industry pays for and hires scientists to advise them about what is safe and what is not. And those scientists understand sort of what they're allowed to report back and what not. It's gone on like that for a long time.
You do go into great detail about what is not understood about prolonged exposures to what are referred to as low dose or low level radiation. Explain what that misunderstanding is.
Yeah, this is the part where Doug is going to look sort of concerned that I'm going too far.
You're not going too far. You have something very important to say here. I just think you have developed an idea that the evidence is not fully in hand yet to completely confirm your thinking.
Yes, yeah, that is correct. So let's speak carefully. The book talks about a hypothesis in this area. So we're talking about something that is not proved, it is a hypothesis. I believe very strongly that the hypothesis has to be true due to physical and mathematical reasoning, but it hasn't been peer-reviewed and it hasn't been proved out. So all of those things are correct. Regarding the question, I can say forthrightly, there's an idea, X-rays and gamma rays and beta particle exposures are kinds of exposures that are given a weight, and that weight is one. They're all the same. So in terms of an exposure, they have a certain probability to cause injury, meaning cancer. Other kinds of radiation, like neutrons, hopefully no human being is exposed to neutrons, but it does happen if there are accidents. Or alpha particles, and that's the case for radon, have other weighting factors that are higher. So for an alpha particle, the weighting factor is 20. So and at a certain dose of alpha particles that you inhale, you know, from radon in your basement, that is multiplied by 20 to give the probability of harm compared to an X-ray. All right. Scientifically, the name for this sort of approach is called a fudge factor. I think the weighting factors are fudge factors.
Very technical term.
That's a technical term. A fudge factor is a technical term. So the fudge factors are derived from a field in radiation biology called microdosimetry. It was mostly developed by one guy working at Columbia. His name was Harold Rossi. He developed this whole field of microdosimetry, and he was very smart. And these equations in the paper, it's a 70-page paper that was written 50 years ago. I have it. It's on my desk downstairs. It's very clear, in fact, in other papers, it says this often forthrightly, that the assumption is that for all of these equations, for the fudge factors, the exposure happens all at once, and it's instantaneous. And there are consequences. If you make that assumption, then you do all the math and you come out with an answer. And all the scientists know that this is the answer. There's something called a linear quadratic form. It's derived from microdosimetry. So everybody remembers this. It's in the books. It's what they learn in school. It's applied to the exposures from Japan from the atomic bombings. And then so there's, you know, there's this experimental data from the atomic bombings. It is experimental data. That's an atrocious way to think of something that happened to human beings. There's a model using microdosimetry, and we have an answer. Like, oh, well, the answer is this low-dose exposure from Three Mile Island or whatever didn't harm anybody. The assumption that the exposure had to be instantaneous has been forgotten. The mathematics, if you do them properly, when the exposure is not instantaneous, give a dramatically different answer. And that's because nature averages using something called an ensemble, which accounts not only for the number of interactions that happen, but also how often they happen, which addresses the concern about the exposure not being instantaneous. But the bottom line thing is that we're using a model in which the exposure is considered to be instantaneous to describe exposures that are protracted, lasting for minutes or hours or even days. And that's a fundamental error. And the authorities have forgotten that that assumption is buried in there. They should not have done that.
That played out very specifically in the chapter about Three Mile Island, which I was there. Your maps were very instructive to me about the fact that, yes, I was walking around outside in the exact place that was the deepest purple, meaning the greatest intensity of radiation, at the time the radiation was there. This just gave me further confirmation. Can't say it made me happy, but at least it solidified some information for me.
Yeah, you were in Middletown.
I was actually in Royalton, and I walked into Middletown along the banks of the Susquehanna River. And was outside for several hours during that day in the late morning, early afternoon. So this was of personal interest to me. And I came across a concept in there I'm not familiar with, and that is the contradiction between physical measurement of radiation dose and biological outcomes. In simple language, what does that mean and why is it important?
At the end of that chapter, I say, and I think this is a correct insight, that the proponents of nuclear power technology are principally based in the physical sciences. They're physical scientists and they're engineers. And this is the mode of thinking that they employ. So the doses, to the extent that they're known, that were measured from Three Mile Island were measured with electronic devices called thermoluminescent dosimeters, or TLDs. That detail doesn't matter, but it does matter that those are electronic devices. Now, the internet is also an electronic device, and you know not to believe everything you read on the internet. It's interesting that a TLD will register 2 millisieverts or whatever was registered, but a biological indicator is actually what's necessary to determine what happens to a biological organism. I'm not a TLD, I'm a person. So my chromosomal response to the ionizing radiation is not necessarily described by an integrating detector like a TLD. To the degree that it's possible, therefore, I think what the chapter asserts is that we should be thinking about biological measures of injury. is it possible to give a direct measurement biologically rather than with an electronic device of what happened? The fact is that that was done, and Dr. Briggy and I are doing it again.
There was one example that stood out for me where you were talking about the numbers, the level of exposure that was being presumed versus the story of an individual who lived within 4 miles of Three Mile Island reporting what happened to his body as a result of having been out there at a time and in a way that there wasn't, quote unquote, supposed to be any impact from the radiation, according to the quote unquote experts. I'm wondering how often you've been able to track and how you've been able to quantify that correlation between they say that nothing happened, but here are the examples of the people who were there and what actually happened to them.
There's been a lot of work addressing this question by people who came well before us. There's something called the Katagiri Report that I think is mentioned in a reference in the book. In terms of what we've done, I think the answer to the question is that we have examined so far 26 people for cytogenomic analysis. Those selections were based on location, so based on that plume map that's in the book that you saw in which you located yourself. But as for our own study, we haven't yet unblinded who was exposed or not exposed to reference it to the results in terms of the chromosomal injuries that we may be finding.
The issues of the problems of nuclear waste and the problems of nuclear proliferation are addressed multiple times in publications, in books, in discussions like this, in webinars. What is it that the chapters in this book bring to the table that perhaps we've not been aware of before?
I'm not sure I agree with you that the connection to nuclear proliferation, nuclear weapons proliferation, is discussed widely and broadly. I think it's discussed in your circles widely and broadly, and I think there are sources. But in the public sphere, I think there has been a substantial effort to claim that those two, that nuclear power is not a factor in nuclear weapons proliferation. And so what I tried to do in that chapter, with obviously with Aaron's help, is to show that nuclear power is a necessary but not sufficient basis for developing nuclear weapons. And for me, the example, which is again is in the news and is more acute now than when we wrote the chapter and when it went to press, is Iran. You know, Iran is enriching uranium, and they claim that it's for peaceful purposes, but then they keep enriching more higher and higher levels. And it's clear they're not only interested in it for peaceful purposes. Israel clearly is aware that that's not the case and has done everything they can to stop it. That relationship of either enriching uranium or using waste from nuclear power plants to extract plutonium is a very critical part of having the capacity. It's not the only part, but it's a critical part of having the capacity to build nuclear weapons. And I think the public is not, if you went out on the street and asked a bunch of people, I think most people would not have a grasp of that problem or think that that was a serious concern or a problem, despite the news coverage of Iran. So I feel like at least the weapons proliferation issue is one that has not gotten its fair attention. Now, I think the high-level nuclear waste has gotten more attention, but I wonder if many Americans are aware how widespread that problem is. It's not just the United States. The United States is in a particularly bad position in terms of finding a way to dispose of this waste. There has to be a way, right? I mean, it's already been generated. So there has to be ultimately be a solution. But, you know, the first country very recently to have a geological repository for high-level waste is Finland, and that is just in the last couple of years. I don't know whether it's come online. I don't know if, Aaron, if you've been following it. It's been sited. It's being built. I don't know that it's actually in use yet. But this is 70 years after we started generating this high-level waste. Finally, the first repository is online, and you know, in my opinion, there are questions and concerns about whether that's even going to be adequate or not in the long run. So I think there is an awareness about high-level nuclear waste. I think it is probably fairly superficial in most of the public and should be taken to heart in a more serious way.
If I may add, I think a nice thing that the book brings forward that isn't widely appreciated is just how little material is required to make a bomb, how little material is required for criticality. I feel like the story from Carl Morgan about a criticality accident at Y-12 that happened because a janitor put a bucket under some leaky equipment and a nuclear bomb basically went off in their laboratory. It takes very little material. So in a case where 5 pounds of plutonium, I mean, this is like, that's like a fist size amount. Are you going to keep track throughout the whole world of little 5 pound nuggets of metal stuff? Like, it's extremely dangerous material. The uranium bomb is much larger, but once you have enrichment, that's a genie. You can't put it back in the bottle for the most part. Although another thing that I learned actually that I didn't really know is that there have been countries that built the bomb and then renounced it. So in terms of nuclear non-proliferation, that's really interesting. That's South Africa, probably in collaboration with Israel and France, you know, had a nuclear program. They detonated a bomb and then they went back. They don't have the capability any longer. So I find that story really, A, really hopeful and B, not widely known.
I've said this for a number of years, but how many enemy countries facing each other off with nuclear weapons do we want? You know, now we've got North Korea has nuclear weapons. We've got Pakistan and India. Israel has nuclear weapons. Maybe Iran is going to build one. Even if it takes decades or a century for to have more and more and more of these, it just doesn't seem like a good idea to me. And at some point, something's going to go wrong. And so I think we need to rein back the number of countries and the number of nuclear weapons. And I don't think spreading nuclear power to a lot of new countries is helpful in that scheme of things.
If I had the opportunity to write an additional chapter, which eventually we abandoned, I think Something's Gonna Go Wrong would have been a good title for the final chapter. Yeah. Because that's how I feel about a nuclear power plant as well. These things are not simple. Any machine that you make is going to break at some point in some way that you didn't predict. And the consequences of that are a thing that you can't understand. We have a nice list of how many nuclear accidents there have been in the book.
Well, that was a very helpful contribution of yours, Aaron, because I wasn't aware of how long the list was. I know the public thinks Chernobyl and Fukushima now, and people who are old enough think Three Mile Island. But beyond that, I don't think there's a substantial public awareness of the large number of other accidents or near accidents that have happened.
Yeah, the public pronouncements are all about technical competence and ability and how wonderful our technology is. That's a badly informed view of what engineering is. Real engineers know that everything leaks and everything breaks eventually and understands the limits of your knowledge in these very complicated systems.
Yeah.
So as a very fancy engineer, I actually get very incensed when engineers say, oh, it doesn't leak, it's fine, we know exactly what it's going to be. And it's fantasy, it's not engineering. It makes me very upset. I wish ordinary people would look at those experts and just say, you're full of yourself, because it's hubris.
No, you're absolutely right. But the, you know, the added point is that the consequences are so substantial with nuclear power. If you're talking about the failure of 1 in 10,000, cars to have their brakes not work right or something, that's bad, but it's not the same as Chernobyl or Fukushima. So I think there has to be a very high standard, and that's part of why nuclear is so expensive, because especially in the United States, is because there's a lot of regulation, whether that's sufficient or not. Some of the pushback is to loosen up the regulation so it won't be so expensive, so you can build these things faster and less expensive. For me, the opportunity cost that Aaron started with is the real nail in the coffin, though, because ultimately, if nuclear is too expensive and too slow, that just renders it, putting everything else aside, and the other things should not be put aside. They are serious, important issues. But all by itself, the economic problem really seals the argument, in my opinion, about whether nuclear is a viable option or not.
One of the dangers that you did go into great detail about are in a chapter called The Impossible Battle Against Dust. And by this, we mean radioactive dust. What causes it? Where is it found? And what makes it such a danger separate from all the others that we are familiar with and talk about?
We both know a great deal about this in different contexts, Doug, because dust is definitely in the mines. It's a serious issue. We'll talk about the mines first.
Sure. I was just talking to a reporter about uranium mining. Radon is a product of the uranium decay series. The decay series itself is a remarkable thing. Its atoms, which are usually indestructible and eternal, giving off a radioactive particle and changing into a different element. And that's a remarkable thing. And the uranium decay series is particularly remarkable because it has so many steps. You know, it goes through thorium and back to uranium and then to radium and then to radon. And radon is a gas. And all of those decay series, radon is the one gas, and it has a half-life of about 4 days. It can seep out of the rocks or soil and get into the air. And then when it decays, it turns into a series of so-called radon progeny, which are additional solid, in this case, radioisotopes that are also radioactive. And because they're solid, they attach themselves to particles in the air. You breathe them in, and then they can lodge in your lungs and continue giving off radiation as the decay series continues. And that damage is extremely strong. I believe radon, or radon progeny really, is probably the most potent carcinogen that we know of. Very tiny amounts increase the risk of lung cancer. And in the early years in many countries, not just the United States, uranium miners suffered egregious harm from working in underground mines with poor ventilation. There are ways of reducing that risk. I don't think there's ways of eliminating it if you're underground. It's also a risk in some people's homes. You know, if a home is built on rock that has uranium ore in it, and is built in such a way that it can diffuse into the home, then you get radon in homes. And actually, radon is the second leading cause of lung cancer after tobacco smoke, smoking tobacco in the U.S. So radon is a very serious concern. It's part of uranium mining. It's a primary reason that uranium mining is so much more hazardous, underground uranium mining, so much more hazardous than other kinds of mining. And the legacy of damage that it left, not just in the U.S., which I go into in that chapter, but around the world, wherever uranium was mined in the 50s and 60s, is quite significant. And I don't think they say it anymore, but it used to be this mantra in the pro-nuclear world that nuclear never killed anyone. Well, there are tens of thousands of uranium miners who died. There's just no question about that. It is proven beyond a doubt over and over and over again. And some of it was silica dust, but a lot of it was lung cancer from radon or radon progeny. So that's an aspect of this.
In terms of number of deaths and nuclear never killed anybody, which Doug just pointed out, in some ways I view what we tried to do in this book as a means of asking for a proper accounting. This is about accountability. On one side, you have a group of individuals, a group of institutions saying, this is good, there are no harms, no one dies, it's environmentally friendly. And we're like, no, let's take the problem apart piece by piece and look at what a proper accounting looks like. It's a big question. There should be a proper counting also of how many people die from particulate air pollution when you burn coal, how many people die of particulate air pollution when you burn gas. And one of the things I liked about this project is that Doug is an expert on particulate matter and air pollution. So we definitely had this in our minds all that time. But it's about accounting. It's recognizing what all the risks are and enumerating them. Now, about the section of the chapter on accidents you're asking about, Libby. Dust is an issue with nuclear power plant accidents because the materials in a nuclear reactor are ceramics in many cases. So a ceramic is like a coffee mug, and if you drop your coffee mug on the floor and it shatters, little pieces of that material all over the floor, from shards that you can pick up down to little pieces of dust that are microns in size, fraction of a millimeter in size, that you can try to vacuum up, but if they're left around, they'll blow in the air and you could breathe them in. And that's what a ceramic is. That's what a ceramic is like. Now, the ceramics in a nuclear reactor, A, are radioactive, and B, they're in a situation where they're heated to extremely high temperatures and the whole thing is vibrating. And in the case of Chernobyl or Fukushima, it exploded after melting. And those accidents lost containment. So there were probably 6 tons of radioactive material expelled from the Chernobyl reactor as dust, and it blew over a vast area. There's a story in the chapter, which I lift from an excellent book by Professor Brown at MIT, about the dust wound up in the coats of sheep, and the workers in the mill where the wool was collected from the sheep got radiation poisoning, and a lot of them died very horribly of radiation sickness. This is because of small pieces of dust. And there's a nice picture in that chapter that I think really brings it home. A gentleman in Japan wore a mask like we all wore during COVID. This was before COVID, of course. And he's 150 miles from Fukushima, but this was, I think, March 13th of 2011. There was a plume from Fukushima, blew over, he went outside, and there are tiny particles of dust laden with radioactive cesium that got caught in the mask. And he kept the mask in a drawer, and 10 years later, he went back and he put a piece of film. This is how radioactivity was discovered, by putting a piece of photographic film on top of a sample of uranium. And you can still see the radioactivity from the cesium microparticles on that mask 10 years later. They're still there. So if you were outside in Tokyo, which honestly probably should have been evacuated after Fukushima happened, except that you can't evacuate a city of 15 million people. They have nowhere to go and no way to get to anywhere. If you were outside, those cesium microparticles were in your body. You breathe them in. They're in your lungs. And anyone who denied, that's not good. No one will say that it's good. Just how dangerous it is actually a question I think the real answer isn't known. But it can't be denied that was there. At the time, I remember, I was aware of some work where people took air filters out of cars in Seattle a week or 2 weeks after Fukushima, and those air filters were radioactive because the plume from Fukushima blew across the Pacific Ocean, and you know it was there in the United States as well. I also saw some of that radiation came over in the jet stream and rained out over places like St. Louis, and there were detections of that as well. It's worldwide, A, I think I got a little bit off track here, but B, how do you corral several tons of material dispersed into tiny particles a micron size you can't even see? That is an impossible battle. It can't be done. So that seems to me to be a serious problem that people don't talk about.
You mentioned burning coal. Burning coal is not the answer. And it shouldn't be a trade-off of nuclear or coal. Burning coal is extremely destructive and harmful, and it causes a lot of death and illness around the world. So I just want to be clear about that.
The point I was trying to make, if I failed to make it correctly, is a proper accounting looks at all the harms among all the options.
Well, one of the very interesting things, very new research emerging, which we did not discuss in the book, is this particulate air pollution, which is extremely toxic and is one of the leading causes of mortality and morbidity globally. It has radiation on it, wherever it's coming from. And that radiation is independent of the particle mass associated with adverse health outcomes in some very leading edge new research. So maybe the two issues are not so unrelated as you might think they are.
I'm not ready to write another book.
Nor does he have to, at least for a while. Doug Brigge and Aaron Datesman, they are co-authors of the new book, Dirty Secrets of Nuclear Power in an Era of Climate Change. There was so much from this book to cover, we ended up talking for more than an hour, which is why this is just part one of a two-part interview. The second half will be on the show in the next week or two. Meanwhile, you can get a free PDF of the book by going to our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 697. Once you're there, click on the link to a free download. And we will also show you a copy of that map of the Three Mile Island radiation plume and where the hardest hit areas are located. By the way, when you look at it, that far south purple section closest to TMI, that's where I was.
Activists, shout out.
First, an apology. It has just been brought to my attention that the contact us link on the Nuclear Hot Seat website has not been functional, and I have no idea how long this has been going on. But if you have tried to contact the show through the website and have not heard back, I'm not being rude. I just didn't know that you were trying to get in touch. So please forgive the delay and reach out again. I promise I'll get back to you. A little bit of fun for Halloween. If you'd like to get the wit scared out of you, there's a list of 10 nuclear war movies that are downright terrifying. We'll give you a link where each one is explained, but the list includes Threads, The Last Island, Failsafe, Miracle Mile, The Day After, On the Beach, When the Wind Blows, 5, The Day the Earth Caught Fire, and Testament. I have to admit that I haven't seen most of these, and given that I deal with the material I deal with on the show every week, I doubt that I want to have more nuclear terror. But your mileage may vary. And happy Halloween. And now some sad news to share. Our dear friend and colleague Laura Lynch has passed away. She was a gifted graphic designer and one of the strongest pillars of strength for sharing updated anti-nuclear news, actions, and events, especially in the U.S. Laura was one of a small group of people who post Nuclear Hot Seat on social media every week. She also worked closely with Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, designing most of their graphics and memes. She ran the Coalition Against Nukes Twitter account for years and was tireless in promoting posts that expanded the safe energy anti-nuclear message. She made no fuss about her illness, and most of us did not know about it, from metastatic breast cancer. She will be sorely missed. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 28, 2024. If you'd like to make certain you never miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat, we make it easy. You can sign up to get it delivered by a single email every week, which contains not only a link to that week's show, but a bit of information about the contents. You can do so by going to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big yellow honking box right there. Put in your first name and email address, and every week we will shoot you out that episode as soon as it posts. You can also sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel. Either way, you don't have to hunt and fish for Nuclear Hot Seat. It will be right there waiting for you when you're ready. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. And especially with our milestone 700th episode coming up, you might want to send us a little something to help us celebrate. And we celebrate every time we hit our monthly nut. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi, Hardestry Communications, and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed. As long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, acute radiation illness, such as the massive doses Chernobyl liquidators received, is an accident. Chronic radiation syndrome, such as we are exposed to at low doses from accidents, reactor releases, uranium mining, leftover fallout, radioactive waste, and a multitude of stupid nuke tricks, is a crime against humanity. There you have it. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.